philosophy is quite an invention. Now, I'm not one of those people who thinks that things arise out of nothing. Obviously, there was a lot of reasoning before Pythagoras, and we're going back 100 years ahead of Pericles here, but sophistry has been around for as long as humanity. Sophistry is sort of, how could you call it? Sort of like using reason to make your neighbors look foolish. I think that that's always been popular, will probably always be popular. And obviously, even the animals reason. They use reason in order to get their food, in order to figure out what they're going to do next. They don't just automatically, you know, pick the best thing. They think about it for a second, maybe not much longer. But reasoning is really, you know, a part of our life. So I'm not saying, and I will not try to say, that Pythagoras discovered reasoning. No, but philosophy is something different than reasoning. And maybe one way of looking at it is there haven't been a lot of real philosophers in the 2,500 years. I think philosophy is really in its infancy still. Because philosophy is a way of looking at things. It means, and Pythagoras is the man who made the word up, it means love of wisdom. Now, most of the time people, you know, even if they say they enjoy their work, if they're professors, that's one thing, you know, but to be really passionate about your work, that happens sometimes. But to be really passionate about looking at the first principles and picking them apart and ruining everything that your whole life is based upon, this takes a slightly different viewpoint. Now, Pythagoras obviously had it. And there's a lot of myths about him, and I want to talk about that just a little bit later. But the basic thing about philosophy is that you have an enthusiasm for figuring things out that give you the wisdom to live life. Not, as I say, to impress your neighbors, but so that you're happier, that you're a happier person. And the thing about real philosophers, I think, the people who have that passion, that is that they have a certain lightness and clarity to their work, which has lasted for thousands of years. Socrates certainly had it. Plato had it. Even Aristotle, who was a little bit dourer than the other guys, he had some of this. Euclid, Archimedes, lots of mathematicians in the early days had this too. And why? Because they were Pythagoreans. Almost all mathematicians that made an impact in the first 1,000 years after Pythagoras called themselves Pythagorean. Now, there's a lot of arguments about what he actually did, what he actually accomplished, what his, you know, conclusions were versus that, and we don't have any clear records, so I'm not going to make those arguments. But I think it's very clear if you look at what was accomplished and you take all of the tangential lines and move them backwards, they all converge on one mind, and that mind is Pythagoras. Now, there were a lot of other people that contributed tremendously to ancient Greek culture. But I think if you had not had this enthusiasm for what I'm about to describe, what he did, I don't think you would have had Pericles Athens 100 years later. You had the base on which that was built had to come from something. And one of the ideas, which I think is very, very clearly a Pythagorean idea, is certainly seen in all the art that you've seen before here that's been going over and everything. There's something different about classical art than modern art or many other forms of art at different times. And I think you can define it as one thing, and that is classical art is based upon an idea that reality is beautiful. Beautiful. And that is a very unusual idea. Even an idea in ancient Greece was not an unusual, it was an unusual idea, because the whole Olympian pantheon is based upon the idea that it all came out of chaos. Chaos is not the idea of beauty. Cosmos is the idea of beauty, and cosmos is a word that Pythagoras made up. Cosmos, the order and harmony of the universe. So he was a man who looked at things differently. And why did he look at them differently? Well, I think we'll talk about that a little bit, but basically that concept that reality is beautiful leads to a very enthusiastic idea about life, for example. If you think that life is ugly and all suffering, you don't tend to be as enthusiastic about waking up every morning as you do if you think that it's beautiful in some way or another. And if you look at classical art, not only do they attempt to make things beautiful, but they also attempt to make things harmonious. Now, harmony is another big idea that is very clearly goes right back to the man Pythagoras. So he is extremely influential from an idea point of view. We won't try to figure out exactly what he did and what he didn't do. There are a couple things that we can say that he didn't do. We'll go into that a little bit later. But I think now that you're all back from lunch, we'll take a little walk back into ancient Greece again, since we came back into the present. And Athens, as everybody knows, up in that section of town. Now, if you go over here, there's an island called Samos. Some sort of big island right off here off what's now the Turkish coast. Samos is where Pythagoras was born. But, and I won't spend any time on this because Margie's lecture and her slides were so perfect. But what you see on the Acropolis is harmony, mathematics, and beauty. All Pythagorean ideas. Now, it doesn't mean that the people in Periclean Athens called themselves Pythagoreans. Most of them probably didn't. But the cultural ideal was there, and everybody was running with it. Click. There. So I'll go right past that because we had it. Now, this is one example of Athena. And Margie had actually better slides and everything, but it wasn't quite, one thing to know about the art and the architecture of the time, it wasn't quite what we see now, this stripped down, you know, bare marble and all that it was very colorful, and it wasn't this abstract classical ideal that we all like to think about, because we think about it classical ideals in that way, because that's the way the ideas are, that's the way the philosophy is, but the art was exuberant the way most art is. Now, in Nashville, Tennessee, they made a copy of the Parthenon. I'm sure some of you have seen it in Nashville. And they have a copy of Athena. And this is what she looks like now. that would be rather impressive if you walked in. Obviously, this is the kind of thing that you'd probably have in an Indiana Jones movie at the end of a great escape of some kind. But Nashville was very intelligent when they built their copy of the Parthenon and their copy of Athena. One, they didn't use real gold, or Fort Knox would have been complaining. And they used cement instead of marble. And so, as I think it was gone into, but maybe not in complete detail, the Parthenon and the Acropolis cost what the equivalent of billions and billions of dollars today to build in 15 years. And most of the money was embezzled by Pericles from that fund all the different Athenian city-states that had to contribute to their military support. That's where the money came from. As Pericles said, well, we're keeping the Persians away. It doesn't matter whether we're doing anything or not. And if we don't have to do anything to do it, then we can use the money. So we move from Athens 100 years back in time to Samos, this island. Now, Pythagoras did a lot of traveling in his life. And there's a lot of stories about all kinds of travels he did, which are probably not true. But the travels he did were not so impossible. First, his father was a trader, a Phoenician trader, and therefore was in ships all the time. And he traveled from Samos to Miletus, which is an island just about 50 miles away. And in Miletus, there were two philosophers before the word philosopher was used, Thales and his student, Anaximander. And they were still alive when Pythagoras was a boy or a young man. And he is said to have traveled there and studied. And then he went to Egypt, and studied in Egypt. Apparently, according to the legends, Thales told him he ought to do that because that's what Thales had done. So some things are not changed between professors and their students. I did it, and I performed well, and I think that you can too. So, and the next place that he went to was Babylon. There's some stories that he went to Babylon because there was a fight between the Babylonians and the Egyptians, and he was carried away as a slave, and then made himself, you know, well known in Babylon as well. It's very hard to understand whether anything those stories are true, but it's not that great a distance to travel. It's about 750 miles from Samos to Thebes. It's about 750 miles from Thebes to Babylon, and then maybe 1,000 miles back home. So if you have 10 years or 15 years or longer, you certainly could do it at any time. And so it's not at all an impossible story. All right, this is a picture, a little clip out of the School of Athens by Raphael, one of the famous pictures of Pythagoras. Obviously, you know, done 2,000 years after he was born. But in the school of Athens, which is in the Vatican, Raphael painted all the secular saints that the Catholic Church thought were acceptable, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, all the ones that they allowed into limbo, as somebody was saying the other day. You can't go to heaven, you know, but we're not going to make you suffer because we borrowed so many of your ideas, I guess. It's sort of like paying a copyright fee. Now, this is a nice bust of Pythagoras, and I'll tell you a little bit about him and find out how much time I have left. So Pythagoras' story, first of all, it's very clear that, first of all, civilization is based upon everybody making a contribution. Now, obviously, Pythagoras' contribution was a little bigger than others, but I don't mean to state it out of proportion. It seems to me that out of the billions and billions of people on the planet, everybody gets their 2 cents in for human civilization. And I think that the outstanding characters probably get about 3 cents in. So we'll say that Pythagoras' 3 cents and the influence that they had have to do with the mathematical ideas that he had, this idea of the harmony of the spheres, an astronomical idea which I'll go into a little bit later when I do my Pythagorean role. Another idea he had was the brotherhood of man, that mankind is just a brotherhood, and that brotherhood is how we're all connected. Now, obviously, he had traveled, and as you can see, that this idea, it may be that he had good brothers, it may be that he had bad brothers. I sometimes wonder about that, because if he had bad brothers, it might be more a better explanation for why he came up with the idea that mankind is a brotherhood. The idea that there was a brotherhood of mankind is certainly one of the base ideas that helped the city-states get together to define themselves and move against the Persians, at least a local brotherhood. And he had ideas about the sun and the earth, astronomical ideas. He came up with this idea of the harmony of the spheres, an idea that even the planets revolving around the earth or the sun, he looked at both ways, that they are spheres, and they make spheres around this planet, and that might create a certain kind of sound, and that sound should be in harmony. And he had a very large number of things that dealt with that. But he also came up with this idea that everything is number. Now, I'm going to try to give you an explanation of how he might have come up with that idea. But I wanted to explain one thing, and that is this idea, all is number, is a profound idea. And it sounds very weird because, you know, everything isn't number. We know that. But it sounds like something that seems abstract and mystical. And 150 years later, Plato had the idea that everything was based on eternal ideas. Eternal ideas are these great abstract forms, and they're perfect and they're beautiful, and this world, which we know is not so beautiful, but we really want it to be beautiful, is sort of a bad copy of that perfect set of ideas. Well, that is a direct descendant of this idea, all is number, from Pythagoras. And the descendant today is the concept. Now, my analogy is the first amphibian animal that walked out of the water was still wet. Now, when he got out and got on land, started walking around, he's still wet from the water, from the environment he came in. Pythagoras and Plato were still wet from the environment that they came from, which was mystical society and not very much reason. And they were reasoners, but of course they're going to take some of that with them. But now we're all used to it and say, well, why didn't he just say concept the way we do? Well, you know, it takes a while for an invention to come to its clarity, to really get in focus. And as I said, I think after 2,500 years, philosophy is just getting started. For example, an analogy in science is the person who invented the car probably did not have brake lights on it. But after a while, you learn, you know, that brake lights would be a really good addition to your invention. So I think that's the way that I take a look at Pythagoras, being one step behind Plato and moving towards this great enthusiasm for reason and what it could do. Now, I always have a role for you. Now, I want you to imagine yourselves, some of you have a little difficulty with this, but I want you to imagine yourself as Pythagoras' mother. Now, the reason I choose that is because Pythagoras taught women. Pythagoras taught women his ideas. He brought them into his secret society. He taught them about math, he taught them science. You know, in his secret society, it was, don't tell anybody, but A squared plus B squared equals C squared. You know, it wasn't exactly the same kind of ideas that usually were kept hidden, but those ideas were just as revolutionary and just as overthrowing of the current religious ideas as anything else, and of course that always gets you in trouble, so he kept it secret. But he taught a lot of women, and his wife and three of his daughters were all known as philosophers and carried on after he died. I think his daughters did, that is. And 800 years later to show, 800 years later there was a list of all of the important Pythagoreans over the last 800 years since Pythagoras. And there was maybe a list of about 200 names. A man named Iamblichus put it together. And there were 17 female names on that list. Now we're talking about a time, and some of them were the daughters and so on, we're talking about a time when women were not allowed to do anything, and therefore he was breaking one of the biggest taboos of all, and some people call him a feminist philosopher as a result. But, you know, when somebody does something that radical, there's probably a really good idea, and so I figure it must be his mother. I think his mother must have said to him, must have thought to herself, I've got this really sharp son, and I want to learn some things. I'm going to send him out to learn, and then he's going to come back and tell me what he found out. So that's what I think is behind this presentation, which I'm going to give you. I'm going to have Pythagoras come home from Egypt and Babylon after 150, or after about 10 years. Some say it's 40 years, some say it's 10 years, some say it's 5 years. It doesn't really make any difference. But let's say he's about 30 years old. He's been gone for 10 years. He's coming home to talk to his mother about the ideas that he has, and you are his mother. And if you really can't do that, pretend you're his father watching over to the side. So I want you, while you're listening to this, I want you to hear his enthusiasm and get this idea that things are going to change because of your son. And you could probably start getting pretty proud. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, if you sent your son to college in Memphis, Tennessee, that is. And then maybe you went to graduate school in Babylon, New York. And then he came home afterwards, and he has these ideas. And you're sitting there very proudly listening to, oh boy, you know, he didn't do too badly in school. And then you start to think, maybe he'll be known in about 100 years. Maybe his name will still be known, and maybe then they'll know what my name was. But I don't want you to think of what really happened, because then you won't listen to anything I'll say. Your dreams of parental glory will be way beyond, the ability to concentrate on what I'm about to do. So I want one last thing here on before, show this slide. The internet, as we all know, is a really fabulous thing. But I plugged into the internet. I was interested in something. I plugged into the internet. Inner courtyard, picture of the inner courtyard of Pythagoras' parents' home in Samos in the 6th century B.C. And I got a picture. I didn't think that would happen, but I got a picture. So that's it. I'll be right back. So is this on? Mother? Mother, I'm back. Mother. I can't tell you how much that meant to me, that you sent me off. I don't think you'll ever know how different I'll always be because of that. But let me tell you about a few things. First, everybody in Miletus said to say hi. Thales' niece send you her best, and they were all happy that you sent me over there for a little while, but as you know, Thales sent me right on to Egypt. And I know you heard that story, Mom. I know you heard that story because I wrote to you about it, but I want to tell you about it. You know, in Egypt, they don't let anybody in. They certainly don't let Greeks in, into their secret societies. And the Egyptian priests, they were very, very tough, but I had them beat. They kept me for 3 years doing different things. Different restrictions on me, different proofs that I was able to come in and join their club and so on and so forth, but they just kept making it very, very difficult. And I finally succeeded in one of the funniest and actually most ironic ways. and I can still picture it in my mind, and it's it was just so funny because it was actually a cultural difference. They thought that I was doing something extraordinary, and I was just doing something that's not that difficult for a Greek man to do. One day they finally said, okay, we'll let you into society, but and we'll teach you our secrets. Mostly they were astronomical secrets. Those are the only ones that were useful. Actually, most of their secrets were useless information, but I still really wanted to learn, and I wanted to get in there. So they told me, all I have to do is stand at midnight outside the temple door, naked. And if I'm willing to do that, they'll let me in. I said, no problem. I didn't say that. I said, oh, well, okay. So I stood there, midnight, and, you know, they didn't open the door. So 1 o'clock in the morning, I was still standing there. They didn't open the door. 3 o'clock in the morning, didn't open the door. 6 o'clock in the morning, didn't open the door. The sun started to come up. People started to go to work. I was standing there. And the people started laughing. Then they started throwing things at me. Well, I just stood there. I said, they don't know in the Olympic Games, we all do this all the time. So they got very excited when I just kept standing there and all the people were making a mess. And so they opened the door and they pulled me in, and that's how I got their secrets. And I thought, all those other things I tried that were much harder, that was not the worst thing that they could have put me through. So I study there, and I want to tell you, I can't tell you all the stories about that, and Babylon was neat, but I want to tell you about what I discovered, what really, really was interesting. I was listening to some music in a shop one day, and I noticed it was a lyre maker, and I was watching him, and I noticed that the string would vibrate. Under certain circumstances, a different string would vibrate. And I was looking at them, and I suddenly noticed, I started to measure them, and I noticed that when a string is exactly twice as long, it makes a vibration. And then there are other relationships that I figured out over time. 3 to 2 created a certain nice sound, 4 to 3 created a nice sound. And I thought, you know, if we use mathematics and numbers to create music with, we might make a totally different kind of music. So that was really exciting. And I thought, it's really interesting that numbers make such a big difference. And then there's an old thing in Egypt. They have triangles, right triangles. They try to figure out exactly how much space it's going to take and so on. And they had it so that the squares were set up like this. And on a right triangle, you can find that the number of squares for the two sides always equals the other side. But they didn't have any, they just knew that fact, but they didn't have any way of doing it. And I figured out a way of proving that that would always be true. It's A squared plus B squared equals C squared, but, you know, I'll tell you the proof later. you might not like it. So, you know, some people don't really get too excited about it, but it's really interesting because, I'll tell you why, because it makes numbers real. The numbers are behind everything. In fact, I think all is number. All is number. I don't know how to explain that to you, but everything has mathematics behind it. Everything has some kind of order behind it. As a matter of fact, you know, I did some studies in Babylon of the earth and the sun. And you know, everybody thinks the earth is kind of flat, or they don't really know what shape it is, but everything else we see is a sphere. The sun is a sphere, and the moon is a sphere. And I did some studies. Don't really have a clear idea about some things about it, but it looks to me like maybe the earth might also be a sphere. And another thing I'm thinking about, I know you're not interested in that, Mom. Okay, all right. But you know, let me tell you about the bigger idea. The bigger idea is that there might be harmony in the way that all these planets go around each other. And maybe they go around the sun, but that's an idea that nobody can demonstrate right now. So, but there's all these possible things, and it has to do with mathematics. It has to do with mathematics. And there's harmony. If you put the numbers in the right proportions, everything looks better. Have you ever, you know, if you draw something and you have the proportions 2 to 3 and then 3 to 8 or 4 to 9, everything looks neat if you use some kind of mathematical background to it. I think what's the neatest thing about that is, do you know what? You know, the Olympian gods are wrong. Yeah, I know that doesn't sound so good. Okay, I won't tell anybody else. But I think the Olympian gods are wrong because they think everything's based on chaos. But you know what? Everything is cosmos. There's beauty. There's order everywhere. Imagine that, Mom.
Thank you, George.